Okay, this is Bob Nevert, otherwise known as Bob Dobbs, here with Sheila Kern, and she's in the last stages of dumping her library. She doesn't want to carry Gutenberg around with her anymore. And we're going to look at the last few books she has there and see what ideas we get about it. And this is August 10th, 2011. Copyright New Grandview Incorporated, all rights reserved. And starting at 2:48 p.m. Hawaii time on August 10th. Greetings, Sheila. You're supposed to go.
I'll come in with laughter.
Yeah. Okay, so what's the first book you see?
Oh, A Course in Miracles.
Okay, that. What would you say about that? That book now or back then? Or?
What would I say about it without saying what I know Ian thinks about it?
Yeah, we don't have to bring... Okay, well, what did it mean to... What did it show you when you read that in the late 90s, right?
No, I would have read that a little later. I would have read that, like, 2004, maybe 2005.
So what did it show you? What new things?
It was very difficult to read. It's very convoluted. Everything seems to be about forgiveness, and of course, you know, there are a few of us who are talking about it, and we believe that it's Jesus speaking through this. But then
and
you
it was
think,
about
well,
forgiving?
It's a huge
no.
amount of it's about forgiveness, yeah.
And then what were you going to say? A lot of people thought it was Jesus, and then you started to say something else.
Well, it is assumed that it is Jesus, and it's like Jesus' new voice, or it's him speaking now. But then you think, well, why is it so, you know, difficult to understand if that's the case?
The new Jesus is complicated.
He's very complicated. He's a complicated dude.
Well, I just go with titles. You have miracles, and it's a course in how to have a miracle. Well, if something's miraculous, you wouldn't know how it happened. So how could you teach a course in it?
Yeah. Well,
I guess it had another meaning of miracle, a different meaning?
Yeah, because it never really talks about the miracle thing. I mean,
okay, that's true to his title. This will have nothing to do with miracles. It's just going to be a course in it, which has nothing to do with miracles because, of course, a course would not be knowable if it was a miracle. Okay, so what was the course in forgiveness?
I just remember that being the main thrust of it was the forgiveness. Now, maybe it was just the chapters I was on because there's also nothing to forgive. Okay, so I just opened up to page, lesson 121. Forgiveness is the key to happiness. Here
now,
is the answer.
This is written by Marianne Williamson?
No. No, A Course in Miracles is not supposed to be written by Jesus.
Right, but didn't she teach it? She got a name in
yes.
Hollywood talking
yes.
about it.
Yes.
In New York City in the 90s on the, you know, the community cable station, I would see her. Videotapes of her lecturing. So,
right.
Okay, so read what it says that you were starting to say about forgiveness.
Yeah,
page
I just
121.
Opened it up. The title of the chapter is Forgiveness is the Key to Happiness. First verse says, here is the answer to your search for peace. Here is the key to the meaning in a world that seems to make no sense. Here is the way to safety in apparent dangers that appear to threaten you at every turn and bring uncertainty to all your hopes of ever finding quietness and peace. Here are all the questions answered. Here, the end of all uncertainty ensured at last.
What I remember about Marianne Williamson is that sometime in maybe early 2000s, a problem hit her in the media.
Mm-hmm.
She got angry at something. Do you remember that? And she retreated.
Yeah, there was something. Yeah, there was some negative thing where she was no longer the one Yeah, that she was kind of lost favor or something.
Or she, yeah, she, it seems political. She went into the politics or something a little bit. But what mm-hmm. what I thought of at the time when I heard that, I said, there it is. Can't hold to her values once the real action is happening on the TV landscape. Her media image, could she give forgiveness about that, whatever they did to her?
Mm.
She wasn't cool about it. I know she had to retreat. She may be cool about it now, but she got struck, you know, blindsided by her TV landscape or TV body. TV body surfaces as the landscape shrinks as you get more digitized. But TV landscape, her body hit her blindside, and she lashed out at the media or what they did with her image. She wasn't in a state of poise about that. So I thought, there it is, the New Agers talking about an obsolete space and have no clue about where the real action is that is the spiritual test.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I think of. What do you think about that, this stuff that you're reading now?
It's all smoke and mirrors. I mean, it's a really big book. I mean, it's almost like a Bible. And
yeah.
There's just so much nonsensical sentences
double
in
talk.
It.
Double talk.
Yes. Yeah.
Well, did you find it easier to understand back then?
No.
So
I didn't.
Were you
I mean,
trying
there
to...
were whole. There were workbooks, and there were, you know, I would say this comes with text, workbook for students, manual for teachers.
There was some basic stuff said by Jesus, and the course is trying to translate what Jesus said.
Exactly. I think that's the idea.
Well, where's that person today who had Jesus come through him?
I think it's a her.
Okay.
I don't know. Because there's no, you know, there's no author title. There's no author credit for this.
You don't, one doesn't know, never saw who channeled it?
Yeah, I think if you Googled it, I'm sure it would give the name. Now, hold on. How it came.
But they didn't perform in public?
Oh, here it is. It's two people.
On YouTube?
No, here it is in the book. See, I don't even know. There's a Helen Schuschman and William Thetford, professors of medical psychology at Columbia.
Yeah.
It does not matter who they were, except that the story shows that with God all things are possible.
Okay, so if I go to YouTube, let's put their names in, see if they have any footage.
It says Helen, the one who received the material. She's the one that received the material.
Okay, and the other guy transcribed it.
But it appears.
So let's see what comes up on YouTube. Okay, so that's S-C-H or S-H?
S-C-H-U-C-M-A-N. An odd spelling.
U-C-M-A-N. Oh, look at this.
Yeah.
Helen Schuman interview comes up. Okay, let's... of course, David, we're hearing Helen Schuman's voice. In this video, I hear for... What is this? In this video, I hear Helen Schuman's voice for the first time. Well, is this guy interviewing her?
As I mentioned, I went through a period recently where I actually kind of abandoned the Course in Miracles. To some extent, takes me back to the 21-year-old that I was.
Okay, so I'm going to stop that. It says a rare interview. Rare interview which discusses the inner voice. You got to buy it. Oh, click to view sample video. Okay, let's see what Helen Schuckman describes the voice which revealed to her A Course in Miracles. She's an old lady. I don't trust these old spinster-looking people. Zit fail, black. Epic fail. I'm judging you by appearances. This is ridiculous. You see someone like that, someone lost in their New York apartment, you know, hadn't been to a Broadway musical in 15 years, starts hearing voices. Okay, this is completely understandable.
Yeah.
Okay, go ahead.
I just wonder what the voice was.
Her own schizoidness, or ghosts, or walk-ins. You know, there's all kinds of things floating around on the soul level. Soul recorders. You know, the souls are recording, and the things they record can be seen by people who knew the person who transitioned. So it could be a walk-in, but if it's garbled, okay, so what did you get out of it? What's something you got, you remember a major inspiration?
Okay, the only thing I got out of it was because I was doing it with a few people. It was a holiday over a week, and they had this, so we would talk about it occasionally. And one thing I got is that there's nothing to forgive. And I thought that was interesting.
You mean to forgive, you just have to recognize nobody wronged anybody. Is that what
exactly.
you mean?
Exactly. Yeah.
Okay. So that gets you out of the good-evil thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, cosmic awareness back in the 60s, resist not evil. So it's a variation of that idea. And had you put up a lot of good and evil perceptions before that in your life?
Yeah, I would have.
Right. So it's a shocker to hear that you shouldn't resist evil. There is no evil. Okay, so that was the first time you got that idea.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so let's go on to the next book.
All right. Oh, Animal Speak.
You mean George Orwell's Animal Farm?
No, that would be interesting.
Yeah, Animal Speak. Okay, what's
the
that?
The spiritual and magical powers of creatures great and small by Ted Andrews. So it's a fairly comprehensive book. It's based on American Indian. It's a dictionary of animal, bird, and reptile symbolism. So the thing is, an animal comes into your life, or, you know, a butterfly lands on your shoulder, or, you know, a rat comes up and bites you, or, you know, there's something that happens, or you're walking and you see a specific animal, and then you look in this book to see what it means, what's going on in your life. This animal reflects something. It's a message to you from God.
And how did this guy get this catalog, know which animals mean what? Did he inherit it from Native Americans or something?
That's a good question. That is my impression that it was based
on. So it's not
that.
About, yeah, it's not based on, it's not animals talking to you verbally. It's
You're
seeing, touching, bumping into them. It's a communication to you.
Right.
Okay. Two thoughts. I was thinking about this right and wrong thing. By the late 80s, early 90s, the TV body is a major experience for people. Judging the chemical body, the old physical body, becomes atrophied, weakened in holding society together because the new activity is judging celebrities through gossip. Gossip shows. The shifting of judgment, most people's average mental activity, went from not the obsolete chemical body, it went to the media landscape. So the New Age genre rushed in and didn't tell you that your judgment has shifted to celebrity images, discarnate angels, and therefore took advantage that, well, you don't have to be concerned about the physical body anymore. You don't have to judge that. You see? There's the shift there.
Mm-hmm. Nothing to judge.
But you know that everybody in the New Age genre or any field, everybody read reviews of movies and stars and books and recordings and presidents. Everybody was reading reviews of everything, monitoring their value level or their charisma on a public purity level. Like, how pure were they? Did they political correctness? See, that's where the judgment went to. to iconic images, not private bodies and what people did. There was no more chemical body community, so it didn't matter what people were doing, and basically couldn't be bothered paying taxes to even decide who's good and bad and who to go to jail. So I see that first theme of forgiving people is real easy when you're not noticing that you're not forgiving presidents. And,
no kidding. Yeah,
McLuhan said that. He said that the Watergate showed that the area of back, you know, dirty back deal, behind the scene back deal, dirty deals, which was normal in politics, and everybody understood that, because that hidden part of the political space was now made public by 24-hour, 24/7 surveillance of the actions of politicians. That is where the judgment of social standards moved to, and in the private life of people's lives, which before were heavily judged because everybody was, the communities were small enough in a way to judge what people were doing, and they could feel the impacts of behavior of people's chemical bodies, and they couldn't look at the, they couldn't follow the machinations in politics. It flipped, so the public space now was the new zone of purity and ethics, and private actions of the old obsolete chemical body were not to be judged anymore. So McLuhan pointed out that ethics moved to the public space and left the private space. And in that, that emptying of that space is what allowed the gay rights movement to come in. Because they said, well, gee, nobody's judging, everybody's nobody's really following normal ethics and morals anymore. Well, why should we be judged? So they took advantage of the gays moving away from the chemical body to the TV landscape and said, hey, we should not be judged. And so that's the point. And people, you know, divorce was going up. All the old standards of American righteousness were all disappearing in the private sphere. But everybody, you know, you'd get divorced, join an activist group and rail about some politician or some icon in the public sphere how bad they were.
Yeah.
Has that ever been said to you before? Have you ever noticed that?
No. No, that's very interesting.
Yeah, there is that shift. Okay,
the same thing,
so,
only projected.
Yeah, the projecting is always happening in humans, and they just with new technological environments shifted where the judging was aimed.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that's the that's the hidden ground of the forgiveness thing, which the Course in Miracles. I mean, it'd be great if they knew that and they admitted that basic pattern, then told the Course in Miracles, but I don't think they were perceptive enough to even know it. They just thought, this grandmother in New York City thought that these working out these psychological value systems was revolutionary. It probably was for her.
Hmm.
You know, she had never thought of not forgiving.
Well, it's a lot of
forgiving. She never thought of forgiving.
She never thought of forgiving.
Yeah, that was a revolution for her to actually realize, and this would be true for the people that came out of the First World War and the baby boomer and the Depression generation. There were a lot of value judgments going on back then, a lot of community space, and that was tangible. The idea of letting go and judging that would be revolutionary. And she looks old enough to be come from those ancient years.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so then the next one is animal speak. Now, what's interesting, the new technologies were the new animals. And the natural animals, the natural animals of geographic space, they now become communicators. But people were missing the communication being done by the new animals.
What are the new animals? What are you talking
television,
about?
Television, computers, and satellites.
Okay. Okay. So they went back to the old animals. We were just talking about this the other day.
Yeah, they retrieved the old animals and made it sacred and made it one-on-one personal communication. Because how could one know what the animals were telling you unless it's tapping into some ancient tradition based on thousands of years of observation, and I guess the Native Americans would be experts on that.
Yes.
Okay,
and
so when you...
and it's all about symbolism, too, which, of course, I like.
Symbolism,
so
symbolizing what, though?
Oh, geez.
Human behavior.
Well, okay. Yes, human behavior.
Again, ethics and righteousness and virtue.
Well, for instance, the goose is the call of the quest and travels to legendary places.
Oh, what?
That's really okay. All right, yeah. The Martin, good luck in
community. No, the goose. I want to hear that. The goose, if you hear a goose, that is calling you to ancient places, faraway places?
Keynote is the call of the quest and travels to legendary places.
Yeah, but is it tell? I got to read it exactly right. Is it a call for you to go to places?
Well, when it says keynote, it's the meaning to you. It's the meaning to you is it's the call of the quest. So there's a quest that you're being called to.
Oh, so it's saying it's calling you to do a particular kind of quest, and it's to what places?
It travels to legendary places.
That's what it's telling you to engage in.
Or engage in on some level, you know, doesn't have to be take your chemical body.
Right, and what is a legendary place? Is Graceland?
Yeah, there you go. Yeah.
You know, is the White House, is Smithsonian, Grand Canyon? Maybe they mean older, like the pyramids.
Yeah, mythic. Yeah, it's about myths and fairy tales and things like that.
What's funny, most people have been to these legendary places by the photograph in magazines.
Mm-hmm.
And when they go to the legendary places, you know, the people who have trips to Egypt, to the pyramids, those people are going to see if the pyramids look like the photograph. Yep, that's it's like the newfie. He was asked in the bank to hand over some ID to prove who he was. So he pulls a mirror out of his pocket and looks at the mirror and says, yep, that's me. So yeah, it looks like me. He uses the mirror to verify it. So you go to the actual physical landscape to verify what you saw in National Geographic. Anyways, you can make fun of this, but did you want to go to any legendary places when you read the book, or did you want to animal speak? Did you do it? Did any come to you?
I did it. I did do it. I did it for a while. Yeah, or it was kind of like a kind of an encyclopedia, you know. You see something or something's there on your doorstep, and you go, "Oh my gosh, what do I need to learn?" Or
I need to learn? What lack?
Exactly? What is God or Source trying to tell me? You know, what's happening? Where do I need to clean things up, or you know, put more attention on?
Yeah, more purification stuff, purifying your chemical body, or your astral body, your spiritual self.
Or like, yeah, being in school, you know, what's the next lesson? Okay, I have to learn to be more assertive or, you know, something like that.
Yeah, there's a rattlesnake. I guess I got to be sneaky and vicious.
All right, we're going to look up what rattlesnake is now that you said that. It's fun.
It would be in there maybe?
Of course it's in here.
It's got hundreds of animals.
You brought rattlesnake up. Rattlesnake.
Yeah.
Okay, 362. Well, snakes are always about sexuality.
Okay. So they don't give particular snakes.
Yeah, okay. Rattlesnake. Rattlesnake, for example, moves around only during the cool hours of the night. Extreme heat is deadly to it. You may find for yourself that becoming more nocturnal would be of benefit.
Ah, okay.
You see, so this is the sort of thing.
Benefit for what?
I don't know.
Whatever dis-ease you're having. Okay, so that's a therapeutic book.
Mm-hmm.
So are we going to see that all 10 books are therapeutic?
Well, on some level, isn't it all the New Age stuff about that?
Okay,
feeling
so
better.
they're all going to be New Age books. Okay. Well, let's go to the next book.
Okay. Oh, the favorite, The Power of Now.
Who was that by? Is that Eckhart Tolle?
It certainly is.
Eckhart Tolle? How do you say his name?
I say Tolle.
Okay. So, The Power of Now, what a power that is, a big now. So, what did you think the now looked like, or what does he say it is?
It was so funny you asking me all these questions because, you know, I mean, back then I knew it backwards and forwards, and now it's like, whatever.
So this book was a good book for you.
Oh yeah, it was a great book. It's about that if there's only now, then you know, pain is not real.
Pain is not real? Okay, disease.
Yeah, exactly.
So thinking about the future.
Well, he had this revolutionary, or he had this aha moment when he was so depressed for so long, and he was in so much emotional and spiritual pain that he was going to kill himself. And then all of a sudden it all just disappeared.
And he tried to understand that by thinking that he got in touch with the big now.
Yes.
Or a now. I don't know if it was big, but so it sounds like anxiety and thinking about what's going to happen to you in the future is stopped.
Well, it's all about the ego. You know that you leave the ego and the mind behind. The analytical mind and the ego are like always vying. Yes.
Okay. I always liked looking at the media aspects of this. As the world gets more complex, more and more media, more and more information, nobody knows which information is significant, you're going to give up effectively monitoring what's going on to figure out where we're going because you can't, there's too much information to judge it. So the power now is an antidote to the onslaught of the TV and chip landscape.
Okay.
It's kind of dropping out from that. From thinking forward, trying to figure out things. McLuhan wrote in the 60s that everybody's obsessed with the destination syndrome. And the phrase was, where is it at? Where it's at? Well, here, this is where it's at. So people are trying to find out where it was. Well, and land there and be part of that parade or be at the head of it. By the end of the 90s, like you read that in the 90s or...
would have been early 2000s again.
Right. So at that point, people are tired of a destination syndrome, so they're going to decide that they've already arrived or that the now. And what are you supposed to think about when you engage the now?
That's a good question. I think there's a lot of meditating going on here.
A kind of attempt to stop the mind. To stop
yes.
the thinking and
the mind and the ego is and the mind are keeping you from inner peace.
And now was a larger inner peace that surrounded everything. So you want to tap into that.
Right.
Yep.
Yeah,
McLuhan said electric media made the nowness of now more demanding. So the nowness of now is what information societies force people to get hectically involved in a panic state, trying to project the destination syndrome. And then you flip out of that, and you imagine there's a larger now, almost like the abstract psychological space or envelope of bliss that you're going to float in.
But doesn't Ayan talk about that there's only ever now, there's no future and past because that denotes time? So, I mean,
right. No, I don't want to talk about what Ion says. We're talking about what the books were back then. Ion is a different story. He builds on that but changes the people's assumptions. I want to find out what assumptions you had about this stuff before you heard Ion.
Okay.
What did the book? So you think the power of now, does he advocate meditation?
Yeah.
So he's an ad for meditation. So he has to explain that thinking, forward thinking, thinking to save or protect the ego or enhance it is useless. So you're going to stop thinking about your ego, and you're going to think about how well you're tapping into the non-thinking space. That's meditation.
Yeah, he says there's a line here. It says emotion, the body's reaction to your mind. So to him, mind is something that's really the obstacle.
And what do you think mind is? What is some nebulous thing that's connected to the ego?
Yeah. I think mind and ego are, egoic mind.
I heard that I heard he has a very nasal voice, and most people liked his tapes because they would fall asleep to them and help them sleep.
They're very, very monotone. He talks in a very monotone way.
That can't be good.
Quiet. Well, it helps put you in trance, I guess.
Yeah. But no, you need to be able to do many different kinds of voices. It's an entertainment society now. You got to be on YouTube. You got to be able to mimic stuff. You have to be able to perform, entertain people. So certainly his monotone would be an anti-environment. That would be a palliative to the pressures to have many voices, many masks, many personalities.
But that's not something he would certainly not plug into, you know, that he has to entertain or do anything.
He doesn't. No, the reason he's popular is never because of what the author thinks he's writing about. He is meeting another felt need. And that need is people need a balance from all the pressures and all the information they get during the day to put on different masks, different voices, different thoughts, endless pressures to do that. So they want something that's a total opposite of that, and that's a monotone saying you don't have to worry about any voice or mask to put on. Hey, just lay down and listen to my voice and you'll fall asleep or go into the big now. So no, that's the reason. The pressures where everybody adopt different levels of speaking. We no longer were in an equitone, monotone society. So that retrieve the monotone as an antidote to the pressures of being multi-toned.
Okay.
So far these books put me into a psychoanalytic mode. I analyze the ground of the books. Nothing intriguing in the books so far for me.
Mhm. Well, they're not intriguing for me anymore either. But they certainly
were. That's right.
We'll
get
that
on the record. This is not where Sheila is. She's a lot less thoughtful now. So she's not going to evolve.
Much more offended.
What'd you say?
I'm much more offended than this crap.
All right. So Eckhart Tolle, the power of now, you find it hard to describe what you thought the now was that he was referring to?
Yeah, isn't that bizarre? Well, he says that time is an illusion. So he's all about, you know, the past and the present, forget it. The past is a story. The future is also a story. You know, if you're making up a story about it, it's a story. And it says the future is usually a replica of the past. So then now is everything but that, I guess.
Now is what happens before you demarcate the past, present, future. It's some surrounding thing.
Yeah, and he talks a lot about God and love, and so.
And forgiveness, that implies forgiveness.
I don't know that it's that much. It doesn't seem to be a good and evil in here. If I remember that correctly.
Right. He doesn't, The Course in Miracles dealt with people who still had the good evil issue in the 80s. I think that's when it happened, right? In the 80s?
That was 90s. No, that was mid-90s.
Oh, okay. But Eckhart Tolle's been popular in the middle of the 2000s, right? 10 years later.
Yeah, this came out in 1999.
Okay, then by the middle of the decade, he was very popular.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So he's responding to the, it's not an issue of good and bad anymore. It's now an issue of some kind of comfort.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, getting out of the pain.
Okay, well, I don't want to bring in Ion ideas on this. I just want to talk about it. We could say a lot about that, but let's go to the next book.
All right, next book. Ugh.
It was a heavy one, eh?
Well, it's I've got two novel-y type of books that are so New Agey, and they're very much like Native American women goddess things.
Right, but how's what's the novelty?
They're not. I said they're novelty. They're novels.
Oh, novels. Okay.
Yeah, I was doing like an adverb of novel, which.
Right, novelly.
Or novelly, thank you.
So what? Who's the authors? What's the title?
There's the same author. These two books, Lynn V. Andrews.
I remember her.
Do you?
She was,
okay.
Yeah, she lived in L.A. I don't know where she got, but she would write books about the American Indians.
Yep. Early 90s. Actually, one of them goes to Japan. One of them is the Woman of the Sacred Garden, The Arousal of the Inner Fire.
That's one title?
One of the titles is The Woman of the Word, Word, W-Y-R-R-D. And the other one is Shakai, Woman of the Sacred Garden. That's a Japanese-looking one.
So is there... resist not evil philosophy in the characters' spoutings?
These are very dreamy. They're about elders and being taught and past lives and parallel world traveling and sacred objects that are miraculous, magic things.
Are these novels set in our time?
The one of them is, the other one in Japan seems to go back to the past. But that's
so what
question.
Do you remember? What?
Well, I mean, that's a question. What does our time mean if it's a parallel world?
No, but is it, do they have television and cars and in the scenes, in the
no,
environment?
Because of course not, because this is all about nature and nature being sacred and all the things we learn from nature and that sort of thing.
So the novels are set in other spaces, not industrial times.
Exactly.
Well, do you remember enjoying them?
Yeah, I enjoyed them. It's just kind of they're dreamy and, talk all about the spirit and magic and things like that.
And here's this talk about parallel worlds and dreamy things, yet you're in an environment where television magically evokes all kinds of things, takes you to parallel worlds, other scenarios, all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
Then this book, then this type, simplifies the huge variety of parallel worlds you can experience through television or your computer and makes it go back to a pre-technological image. So it's dreamy.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, it's actually dreamy because speech and nature was a technology for primitive peoples. It was a machine that they're always studying to figure out how to use. The dreamy thing is the literate person projecting back that this place, without machines, didn't have the hard edge of machines.
Right.
It was soft. Do they have any murders or violence in the novels?
I don't think so. I think there was some bit of trepidation. There was some threat. Things were threatening, or it was dark things that threatened. But there wasn't any violence.
Right, but you can see that again. The rough spaces of modern life and the modern mediascape. You can see a felt need is to have a dreamy, soft place where really death doesn't matter because it's reincarnation. So there's no finality. So it's an antidote. The book does not serve values of ancient worlds or other kinds of mystical scenarios. It's there to provide another environment, alternative to the modern technoscape.
Yeah, and it's everything stresses about sacredness.
Yeah, it's trying to find an object. See, there's no sacred objects in the mediascape. Something sacred for about 30 seconds, then it's on to something else. So there's no continuity. This is an attempt to get dreamy continuity in an old object. even having parallel worlds as an object, a sacred object, sacred places to go to, when you're going to places all the time in the mediascape. So again, it's trying to focus on the chemical body again, the physical body, but overlaid with the astral body literature of magical places, not as magical as our technoscape, but slower magic, easier magic, dumber magic.
magic with feathers and color.
Yeah,
and,
slowed down so you could fetish it.
Exactly, fetish.
Yeah,
sacred.
I mean, you take. Yeah. We've been watching last year or so. You and I and a few others have been watching some of these TV shows that Ion talks about. So we're watching more TV than we ever did, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now look at the jolts in a TV show. Now imagine someone in the 90s has their TV on all the time, all kinds of information scenarios. Just think of it. 10 hours of CNN reports all over the world, detective shows, whatever those shows were back then, and cartoons and CNN and jumping around. Look at the variety of data that's washing over the person.
Right.
Now, you didn't have that experience. You weren't watching TV like that, right?
No.
So you were like a monastery, and these books enhance the monastic feeling.
Okay. Yep, that makes sense.
But the person who's traveling, now they're doing it in a somnambulistic state. They don't think they're traveling. They're probably just thinking, oh, look, there's a picture of Monaco. I wish I was there. And they don't recognize they're there when they're watching it on TV. And you actually can see a lot more by TV travel shows than if you were actually in a bus going along with a bunch of tourists.
Oh, totally. Absolutely.
And it's slower, and if you have a tape, you can stop it and be comfortable. So the dreamy space. Okay, so let's just say that these books are trying to retrieve healthy tourism when there were actual objects to stay and hang out with, actual places. So it's actually a reminder of when tourism was tourism and not the crazy five-body tourism we have today.
Wow. I'm just looking through this book. It's just every page is about this sacredness and this is this and more sacred.
It's saying the word sacred.
Yeah.
So, it's interesting. Back in the 60s, McLuhan said the city was the new sacred space. Okay, so that's an interesting point. And he said that the sacred, there was a guy who wrote the book on, I think it was Eliot Meliadi, some name like that. He wrote about the sacred and the profane. And the profane was the literate societies. They had a stronger sense of good and evil. So their sense of sacred went into judgment over what was profane or not. But the pre-literate societies considered much of their environment sacred. So
okay. You
have these kind of books are retrieving that ancient kind of sacredness, but they're it's in reaction to the profane world all around them, which is the judgment of the media, the shoddy media content.
Mm-hmm.
So so the profane people look for a better form of sacred. They don't look at the TV environment as sacred.
Yeah. And they see, nature as sacred and the city as profane.
That's right. And McLuhan knew he was being provocative when he said the city is now sacred. And what one way, I don't never had a chance to talk to him about that statement. I only heard him give it on a recording. But let's say he means that more and more the rubes from the agricultural parts of North America were flocking to the cities, like more and more baby boomers worked in the cities more than their parents did, and they moved to soft service industries, right? Sitting at desks, working with computers, and that. I'm thinking the general migration of the baby boomers to bigger metropolises. McLuhan saw as the city was a sacred space of tribal involvement. You know, you were too isolated when you were far away, out in the country.
Mm-hmm.
Because the radio and TV were drawing you into this electric global membrane, but you couldn't find it because it was discarnate. So the chemical body went to a big city to localize a sense of going someplace that the media was drawing you to. And so you had many of those TV shows were based in major cities. Like, what was that one, WKRP in Cleveland?
Cincinnati.
Yeah.
What?
And, you know, think of the Mary Moore. Mary Tyler Moore.
Yeah. Mary Tyler Moore. Yeah.
I might have seen it once, but I remember images of her walking into the city. Walking. It was her city. Remember?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Now, you could see McLuhan, a very detached state of perception, would see these new TV shows in the late 60s and pick that point up. Look, they're making the city sacred. That's an effect here. The old physical, chemical body environment of the city now becomes archetypal. It actually became sacred, but once people got to the city, they actually were living in the magnetic city of electric discarnate traveling through their television, and so they didn't know what was sacred anymore because they thought it would be in the city, but that was just for their chemical body. Meanwhile, they're floating around and traveling with their TV body, and you can see to resolve that conflict would be, well, I'm going to go to some place that's in a book that's slower. And if the author repeats the word sacred, then I'll know I've been in a sacred place because I thought the city would be sacred, at least provide satisfactions.
And it's always, again, looking outside of
where you are.
Yeah. And it's funny because one of those books that we're talking about is one of the main things in the book is a gourd, because it's a sacred symbol, like of a woman's womb, and it's taken all through the chapters and it's put in different scenarios, and it's like the Ark of the Covenant. I mean, it's talk about putting your power in this thing that you're carrying around with you.
And the gourd is a drinking thing?
Well, a gourd is a vegetable. You know, a gourd like a squash is a gourd shape.
Oh, it's not I've seen those hard things. It's not a cup.
No.
Okay,
no.
So you're carrying around this vegetable as a sacred power thing.
Yeah.
And the author the hero is going to different places with it?
Yes. Or finding it, or it's lost, or it's stolen, and if it's stolen, then your power is taken away, and someone has your power, and it's just
so it's a bit of vegetable, and vegetable is first nature. You know, the satellite went around the planet and turned old nature into an art form, into an archetype. It's even shrinking it down by the 90s. Nature now is one little object, one little condensed vegetation.
That's one way of looking at it, yeah.
Yeah, it represents the globe.
Well, I think it represents women's womb.
Oh, is that what it says?
Which is a giver of life, right?
Right.
And certainly that's something that's worshipped a lot.
So here's this. Now, Lynn Andrews, she wrote this book back then. I think they were bestsellers. Do you think she's embarrassed now when she looks back?
I don't know. I mean, it's just the beginning of all the goddess stuff, isn't it?
Yeah.
All the goddess, blah, blah.
So you're a totally different person now. You can't even take the book seriously.
No, really, isn't that mean?
Can you take the Course in Miracles seriously? No. Can you take the Animal Speak seriously?
No.
Okay. Let's go to the fourth book. No, that was two there. That was four and five.
Actually, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, right. Okay, let's see. Oh, how about Deepak Chopra?
Oh, yeah. Now, that guy.
Favorite.
Oh. You like him?
He's hot to look at anyway. But,
okay.
I read a lot of his stuff. A lot of his stuff.
Which one is this?
This is the only one I got left. Is called The Soul in Love, which is really just a compilation of poems he put together of, like, Rumi. So it's like love poems.
Do you know the story about him, the behind-the-scenes story about how he came out of the Maharishi University?
No, remind me. I don't know if I do.
I think he was a high lieutenant in the Maharishi cult.
High Lieutenant?
Yeah, he was a top guy in the Maharishi, you know, the guy the Beatles
okay.
liked.
Okay.
And it was some kind of cult like that, and or spiritual community. And he kind of took the secret Ayurveda medicine they taught there or had there, and he went public with it. And he angered the Maharishi. I mean, he ripped off some of the Maharishi secrets or something.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's what I heard. I haven't read his books. I don't know. And this was someone who was a member of the Maharishi and told me that. That was his perspective as a person who was close to the scene in the Maharishi world or whatever cult it was. So, but all I remember is when he was in the 90s being interviewed, he was like Andrew Weil. He was the alternative to Andrew Weil, W-E-I-L.
Okay. Yeah, no, he is. Uh-huh.
Yeah, who was the replay of Mr. Natural from our Crumb comics with the beard, you know. And,
yeah.
And the friendly beard. McLuhan said the hippies were nostalgic for their grandfathers, so they wore their grandfather's clothes, you know, the farmer overalls and things, and long beards. So here was Andrew Weil for the baby boomers, a retrieval of the grandfather fantasy. And then because the North Americans were going Asian and Eastern, because the sensibility of the East resonate with television more than the book did, the book
mm-hmm.
itself. So you have Deepak Chopra filling in the Asian requirement. You know, the old term Oriental. The Oriental aspect would become charismatic. So you got Andrew Weil doing the rural agricultural sacred rural space, agricultural space of the wise bearded guy. And then you have the slick Indian. Wasn't he Indian?
He's Indian.
Yeah,
and apparently he slept with anything that moved.
Oh, yeah. That's the way most people got through the 90s. That was the only reason to make money. Was it access to chemical body.
Yeah.
Go
well,
ahead.
I had his the spiritual laws of prosperity and success. Whatever the top ten. I don't know. All of them. Prosperity, abundance, spiritual success, knowing God. Oh, I don't know. I read a lot of his stuff.
When I would see, like, I saw a lot of these books in. I was in New York from 1993 to 2007, and I would go through Barnes & Noble, these books, see these books piled up, and they turn over real fast. So I've seen them all, never looked at them, but I'm aware of the trendiness or the many books he did. And I was always disgusted because I said, none of these books show what's really affecting people, the media dynamics. And the media dynamics are what's going to wreck people's lives. And I've always – so I did not respect anybody giving advice out who didn't talk about the McLuhan angle. And nobody knew the McLuhan angle, so I could feel superior to everybody, right?
I was going to say, geez.
that was a good technique to rise above the information garbage. So it was a good mask or attitude to wear, but it worked because in the end it was media. As the baby boomers more and more, as they get into their 60s, realize this more, that all those transient fads, that really what they were being suckered by was weird new techno environments that they – still don't have much clue about. But that's so he was a fraud, you know, Deepak Chopra.
He went into all the laws stuff, the spiritual laws, and it was something that really appealed to me because, you know, I thought, oh, it's scientific and it's vibrational. And, I mean, he did talk about the vibrational aspect of it, of things.
Yeah, which was a ridiculous, nebulous phrase. I mean, is that music, you know, like electronics is vibrational. The music around you in your environment with the kids with their beatboxes, that's vibrational. That's obvious vibrational. See, so he brought in science, the patina of Western literacy, but with an acoustic space resonant interval kind of thing overlapped. So conceptually, he provided a combination of the eye and the ear.
Mm-hmm.
The vibration is the ear. The eye is the orderly scientific organization of data into laws. Okay, so you read these laws. You were looking for laws.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
did the laws, did you use them?
I believe I put them into practice. I mean, again, all these things are, there's so much work, you know.
Did you have the time to do the work?
Yeah, I did. I had the time to do the work, and I don't remember anything really working that well. But it still felt good thinking that there is a law. It felt good that, okay, there's a way out of this nightmare.
Of chaos, of non-visual, tactile, acoustic, kinetic chaos, information overload. See, that's what this is all an antidote to put the data storm in order.
Okay.
And you use some abstract idea of some other space, the larger now, the laws of other realms.
Mm-hmm.
What is the spiritual law? Okay, what is the law that Deepak came up with?
Oh, there were lots of them. They weren't just a law. It's the law.
Well, can you name two?
Yeah.
Well, you can look at the book. If you look at the book.
Well, no, because I don't have those. I just have the Soul in Love. So it's just a compilation of, you know, ancient love
poetry.
Poems. Right.
Well, do you think that his laws you could use now?
No, everything has been. Everything has been rendered obsolete.
Okay, but without going into the present, you can't remember any of the laws. You haven't got a clue, but what's your general impression of what the laws were about?
Thinking certain ways.
There it is, data processing. That's thinking.
And yeah, and then believing and having the faith, but it's always about the thinking.
What does he
acting.
Do today? Is he still doing what he does?
Yeah, he's still doing. He still has he's got a couple centers of well, or one at least centers of wellness.
Oh, here's something about him in relation to the media dynamics. A few years ago, I don't know, 5, 6, 7 years ago, he came out with a book, and he couldn't get on the talk shows, The View and the main talk shows. And Carolyn was sent the letter he sent around to his subscribers,
mm-hmm.
railing against the media not letting him on. Like, he felt he had a privilege. And he knew that if he didn't get on the media, he didn't make any sales. So here's someone being very unpoised, unrelaxed about the fact, and he was outraged, lost his cool about the media were, for some reason, bored of him, and he wasn't an issue or important anymore, or there was some kind of, you know, Republican Party ban on this kind of stuff. I don't know. You know, the Bush era. But he
mm-hmm.
was pissed.
Okay.
And I remember
I could see that.
What?
I could see that easily with him.
Why? Because he had to get laid a lot, right?
Well, yeah, that's saying something.
He was a sex addict. And,
yeah,
you know,
it sounded like
he can't, and you're not eligible to get sex unless you're in the discarnate body. That frees you up for lots of chemical body profligacy.
That's a mouthful.
Yeah, okay. Expenditures, hedonism. Like, he had to make it. The real reality was the discarnate state of getting on the TV landscape so that he could have access to money to keep him flowing around titillating his chemical body nerves.
Mm. Well, hey, one of the last books he wrote that I remember is called The Third Jesus.
What's that about?
I'm assuming it's because he's knew there were three Jesuses, and he's talking about the third one.
Well, that's pretty weird.
Yeah.
Anyways, what is he doing today? He had some centers, and he's worrying about his accounts. They're getting wiped out today.
I don't know. Probably, yeah. Watching the stock market.
Oh, how's it doing? That's the living reality right there.
I think it went down again today, hugely.
Yeah, 500 points.
Yeah, I don't know if it rallied or not.
When's it going to affect you, Sheila?
Well, never, I guess.
Yeah. So what do you, you're watching it. You're still watching something that you might think won't affect you. But you know it will affect you because it is the intertwined environment.
Depends what environment I'm in. You think it's the intertwined environment.
You're in the one that can watch it.
I have never watched it. I'm only watching it because, first of all, you brought my attention to it a couple of days ago. and then I was in a shop today, and someone was talking about it. Went down to the 500 points. And I said, did it bounce back? I said, because, you know, I said the saying is even a dead cat will bounce.
What'd they say?
So, they laughed.
Okay, so Deepak Chopra, let's go to the next book.
Next book. The Artist's Way, Julia Cameron. A Course in Discovering and Rediscovering Your Creative Self.
Is she a heavy Hollywood producer?
She did. She produced...
Oh, a lot of big hits. I remember looking at that book, or, you know, I saw it, noting, oh, there's...
Shoot.
There's
what
a
is
TV
that
produced.
One with... Remember that one with Richard Dreyfuss and the aliens?
Yeah,
Close Encounters of the Third...
Yeah,
no, Close
yeah.
Close Encounters of the Third Kind. She produced that.
So she's one of the first women to be a, you know, baby boomer women generation producer kind of thing, right? To get break the glass ceiling for Hollywood.
Well, apparently, she wrote this book after she produced that. She wrote a book called You'll Never Eat Lunch in This Town Again.
Right.
That's
vicious sounding.
She was slated or something. She got an Oscar and her life fell apart and she just, yeah, she totally trashed Hollywood.
Yeah, now
and
there's...
And of course, she got all spiritual after that, and she wrote The Artist's Way.
Oh, yeah, okay, she's on the other end. She's in the middle creating artistic content for people, or media swirl, and then gets bit in the ass herself, and then doesn't understand what it was, and displaces it, abstracts it into a spiritual antidote. So that's the very thing. So she's the other side of what we're talking about. You got all these people who never were huge, their books made them huge, and their books are trying to tell you how to survive the media swill that Julia makes. Now you got Julia coming in saying, I'm on your side, Deepak. Yeah, that media swill world's vicious. But both of them are affected by the media swill world.
Yeah, this was published in the mid-90s.
Okay, what did you get from that book? What do you think of?
It was kind of an assignment sort of book. I actually never finished it. It's an attempt to, make you loosen up, I guess. You just do journaling in the morning, just free-flowing.
Take time.
Free-flowing
slow
words.
Down.
Slow down, free-flowing words, blah, 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 blah. And, you know.
And here she was, a real artist. An artist making the things that really affected people, like major focus group creative movies like Close Encounters of the Third Kind with all these new amazing effects. And she went to the nostalgic Gutenberg idea of an artist.
Apparently, yep. I don't know what she's better known for.
Yeah, I don't know. I wonder where she is today.
Well, who
what's
knows?
What's her name? Julia?
Julia Cameron.
All right, let's see if the wiki says something about her. Is she still with us?
What's Julia doing? Ooh, this
Wikipedia. Born 1948, she's still alive. And let's see what she does today. She has lived... in Los Angeles, Chicago, Taos, that was when she probably did that stuff, the Taos period, New Mexico, and Washington, D.C., and now lives in New York City.
Oh! Hey, I'll go visit her tomorrow.
Right, she taught a class at the New York Open Center, which is the, you know, the dinky little New Age Center in New York City. Down
is
in
that
the
in
village.
The village? Yeah.
Right, yeah. It's down between Soho and East Village. And below the West Village, down like Prince Street, Spring Street. She has taught at the Smithsonian, Esalen, the Omega Institute, and the New York Open Center. So sounds like she's still doing the New Age circuit.
Mm-hmm. I bet she still has her Oscar on her mantle, though.
Yeah. Cameron's film, God's Will, is based on the Cameron-Scorsese marriage and divorce. So she was married to Martin Scorsese.
Yeah, I didn't know that.
Right, and portraying a divorced, self-centered show business couple who die unexpectedly end up fighting in heaven over what will happen to their daughter. Yeah, they get all concerned about the chemical body expressed in a little child after they got wiped out by the discarnate media. Anyways, what'd you get from that, this book? Anything you remember?
No. I remember that it was too much work.
To do what she asked.
It was too much work to be creative, according to her, yeah.
So that's the conclusion. For most of these books, are too much work.
Uh-huh.
Okay,
yeah.
Well, sounds like you're pretty spiritually evolved.
I guess I am.
You know, if this makes me work, then I'm not, it's stupid. It's not spiritual.
Well, no, seriously. I mean, I did a huge amount of work. I mean, back when I was doing that for 10 years, I had, you know, I did therapy, I read all these books. I did work weekend shops, I went to retreats, I did stuff, you know. I mean, it wasn't that I didn't do the work.
Yeah, you didn't know it was too much work.
I didn't know. Exactly.
But eventually
you
get burnt out.
Yes.
And I would say it was too much work because it was focusing on your physical body and your astral body image, and you never could complete yourself because the TV body and chip body were there haunting you, whether you used them or not. See? So you'd burn yourself out. If you could only decide that watching TV or interacting with a computer was a spiritual activity, then you would relax because you wouldn't think you were lacking spiritual activity.
That's true. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Or if I didn't meditate every day, it was, you know, I was less than.
Yeah. And you can see it as a Noah's Ark of trying to save the chemical body and the spiritual body, or the astral body, trying to save them, set aside time to put value in their simple routines, spiritual or physical. You were on a Noah's Ark mission because the main point was dealing with the TV landscape and the chip landscape. Those were the real pressures on you.
Yeah.
Okay, so then the next book?
Next book. Yeah, this would be a good one. How about David, let's see how you pronounce his. Deida? D-E-I-D-A. Deida. He does a lot of what's called Dear Lover, A Woman's Guide to Men, Sex, and Love's Deepest Bliss.
So why are you reading a men's book?
No, it's a woman's guide.
Oh.
To men, sex, and love's deepest bliss.
Love what? You're diminished your vocal power.
Love's deepest bliss.
Okay, so it's men's sex. It means how men do sex or men's gender?
It's a woman's guide to men, sex, and love's deepest bliss.
Oh,
and actually, he actually wrote a book for men. I read that too. That was very interesting.
So he's trying to tell you how to make meaningful chemical body relationship.
It's not just chemical. He brings it to the whole spiritual love.
Right. He mixes in the astral body.
Right.
Astral body being the whole reservoir of human ideas, imagination, literature about stuff more than the obvious physical.
Okay. And there's a foreword by Marianne Williamson.
Okay. What's the date of that book?
2002.
So what's the main idea about men you remember from it?
I actually enjoyed this quite a bit. It made me see things about how men thought that I didn't think before.
Because David Dedea would tell you what men thought.
Yeah, but of course that's just really his opinion, isn't it?
Well, he made raw male desire or the male gaze. He softened it with spiritual baggage or ideas around what men thought they were getting.
Let's see. I'm just reading the back of it, giving an idea. It's in the area of sacred intimacy. So it's a lot of that, sacred intimacy.
Yeah.
The unraveling the mystery of relationship, understanding the feminine psychology, and about God, as it reveals, relates to God. Daily exercise is here. Daily exercises to help you and your partner move from separation to openness in two-body devotional trust.
Two-body?
Two-body devotional trust.
See, misses the other three bodies. Two-body. Well, how puny. But that's like starvation budget. Budget cuts. We only lie to have two bodies.
Yeah, so this is a lot about, again, it's the sacredness about sex and emotions and, you know, how men and women differ and how it can be wonderful. And it's all working on all cylinders.
I think, again, it's what you call turning the old environment into an art form or an archetype. Try and invest archetypal values, spiritual values, in the old, obsolete chemical body reality. Is it deal with homosexuality?
Not in this book. And I don't think I don't remember him ever talking about that. But to me, it's like, okay, chapter 3, yearning is the key to love. Your yearning for love is so powerful that I can feel your heart all the time. I think it's written from a man's, like he talks about a man, I think a man is talking to you and then he goes through it or something. But it's like this,
It sounds like it's the yearning for an intimate conversation with a righteous priest or something, a hip priest. That sacred conversation with a mentor, sounds like.
It's too... I can't even think of a word for it. It's just too, this yearning.
Too precious.
There you go.
Too much preciosity.
Yeah.
But you liked it. At the time, liked it.
Well, yeah, because I guess I'm, you know, I've always considered myself being quite an emotional person or having deep, I'm very deep. I've always been told I'm very deep, whatever that is.
Told I was deep, so I got to go around
deep.
I've been told I'm deep. That's deep.
I've been trying to become more shallow with every passing moment, every time I move.
Yeah, you didn't know how deep, that only one millimeter could be deep. You thought you had to be 6 feet deep.
But I mean, deep is exhausting, you know? It's like, everything is so deep and it's so meaningful and so many facets to it. And you're like, oh, please.
It's too slow. You can't live that slow to go that kind of visual space depth.
Yeah, it is very slow. And takes
okay.
So much processing.
Well, that's interesting. The next book.
Next book. Altars of Power and Grace. Create the life you desire.
Now, that's altars as in religious altars?
Yes.
Altars of what?
Power and grace.
Okay, so what if you look at it, what's striking about that?
It's kind of on the basis of feng shui, where you place certain things a certain way and you create it in your life. You bring the vibration of it into your life.
Okay, now, literacy makes the human being, especially since the printed book, think of a separateness between the subject and the object, or the person and the environment. So they generally thought that they were free to roam in the environment and the environment wouldn't affect them. The electric age renewed the idea that, well, maybe the environment has an effect on me. And that idea that the medium might shape, the environment in might shape me, is what this book is riding on, the renewed popularity of feng shui and the idea that you need to orchestrate your environment. That is not what people thought 80 years ago or 100 years ago.
But did they even have it in their consciousness? I mean, or awareness, because
Which day?
Well, you're talking about people. You're talking about people
today.
80 years ago. No, people 80 years ago, they weren't aware, they didn't have that understanding or thinking, but they still knew if they liked a room, they still knew if they like the color of something or
felt. Yeah, but they would impose their will on it. They did not, your grandmother did not say, what's the vibrational situation here?
No,
you
exactly.
Know?
Yeah, right.
How can I tune in? And you can say the radio environment made people aware that they were tuning into something and they heard music and that. So then the tuning by the 90s goes over into architecture. I can be tuned by my house or its setting. That's what I mean by being affected by the environment. You're being tuned.
Hmm.
And that was alien to the visual, literate, detached sensibility.
Okay. And this book also, I mean, it's very specific. It's almost, again, we're going into the law area of, you know, it's almost a scientific thing of there's grids and there's...
colors?
Colors.
Sounds.
Sounds, directions, different, you know, is it fire, water, or air, or earth, scents, the smell. So
all the old chemical body environments, and literacy is an extension of the chemical body level, it's taking all the old parts of the chemical body environment and making them very precious and saying, you can tune these. You can't tune your TV environment. All you have to do is turn it off and then collectively organize and have the whole network shut down. Then you've got peace, but you're not going to get it. So ignore the vibrational dissonance of the immediate environment and run to the old chemical body and tidy it up and turn it into laws about sight and sound.
Hmm. Yeah, I get that. But what about the part that I just like to look at pretty things and I like them around me?
Well, you can see a lot of pretty things on television.
Okay.
But for some reason that it does not appear pretty anymore. Because it's
right.
Because actually pretty might be a visually eye based thing and there's too much other senses going on in the TV experience. And the literate person gets tired of the demands on his other senses, the acoustic and the tactile and the proprioceptive. So it falls back on the eyeball and really makes that a special fetish. So they can claim they're looking at pretty things when there's thousands of pretty things on the course of a few hours of television. Not all of it's pretty, but they try to make it pretty, but it's not visual television. It's actually too demanding because it's non-visual. It demands all your senses. So you're trying to limit yourself. These are books about making yourself unaware of the present and the now. They're the opposite of what they claim to be.
How's that?
Because the now is being able to perceive the beauty, the vibrations, the colors in the tactile environment of media, modern entertainment media. And people can't keep up with that. They doze out, they fade out, and so they run back to a lazier, simpler way of aesthetics. They get real fetishistic about the lay of their coffee table in relation to the front door.
Okay.
So what was the title again?
Altars of Power and Grace Create the Life You Desire.
Well, Altars of Power and Grace is television. That's a modern altar. But creating your own life, certainly you wouldn't feel that with television because it's created for you. So you go back to the Gutenberg values of creating some eyeball stuff. But then when the chip body came in, you could create your own life. So that title would not do well now because people consider their computer their altar because they can design it.
This is a recent book.
What's the date? 2002, did you say?
2004.
Ah, that's before the crash. That's old school.
Yeah, true.
That is just before YouTube. YouTube and the Web 2.0 comes in 2004, 5, and 6.
Hmm.
So that is before... do you know anybody who's not working on their website? Who's not on Facebook?
No. Well, no, not anybody that's, you know.
Can you imagine putting a book out, the feng shui of your Facebook page? Nobody would have the time to bother such an involving thing. It's not eyeball-based. It's
right.
Only eyeball-based flashiness, but it's your ability to respond to how people will comment on you. Or how you satisfy your sense of putting up new stuff to get comments from. So that's a very demanding interactive situation. There's no time for alterness in the sense of a visually positioned altar that's in one corner and you revolve your life around it.
Right.
That's very passive compared to the activity of the interactivity of the web life.
Mm-hmm. I get you there.
Now that could be a good book or a good idea. Take all these New Age themes and apply it to your Facebook. Finding a sacred space in your Facebook page.
You should talk. You never go on your Facebook page.
Yeah, I did. I basically don't even know you. I don't know much about it. It's just every now and then I'll get an email saying, I commented on your Facebook, on your wall. So I'll click on it, and I'll see some ridiculous thing. It had nothing to do with me, and I'll just ignore it. I like my picture there, though. I think the picture tells everything. I'm gone fishing. I got my little boogie board, and I'm on the beach. You know, that's me. I'm not indoors looking at my Facebook. I create
Talking to you about a book about, you know, furniture placement and things like that is pretty moot because you don't even have furniture. So.
Well,
you're going to, like, poo-poo it.
Yeah, I live in the now. I live in a large now, interacting five bodies, expressing in all levels, and, you know, causing revolutions all over the world. You know, I haven't got time to notice where my chemical body is.
Because it's never sitting on a chair. You don't have any.
Yeah, well, no, I got a chair. Occasionally I sit in a chair, but I often, like right now,
okay,
walk around. I pace. Okay. I pace and jog and do push-ups while doing my consulting. But anyways, yeah, so it's easy for me to poo-poo all this stuff, and it's worth, I think, is a better survival strategy than these books.
Okay.
You're going to be right here longer. Your five bodies are going to be here longer than any chemical body positioning.
So don't bother getting the comfy chair.
Beg your pardon?
So don't bother getting the comfy chair.
Yeah, don't get a comfy chair. Stroll through your house and apartment. Keep moving.
Work. Well, I can't. If I'm painting, I have to be, you know.
Okay, well, yeah, we are talking to an eyeball addict right here. Right here, folks.
Yeah.
A hyper eyeball.
And I'm happy with my addiction, so thank you for asking.
Right. You just don't need to read about it anymore.
Exactly. I'm very aware of it. I've got it down.
Okay. So that was, what was that one we just did? Altars. Okay. What's the next book?
Oh, gosh. Spirit. We're getting down to the dregs now.
Okay. List off the rest of the titles.
All right. I got two books from a guy who I knew in Ireland, a friend of mine. I don't think I've ever read either of them because they're bizarre or they're hard to read. Love, The Mystery and Foundation, and What the Hell Am I Doing on Planet Earth?
Okay, the first one's by who?
They're both by Roderick Knowles. He's an old English guy who lives in Ireland, and he's had a very colorful life.
And he wrote these in the 90s?
He wrote, no. Gosh, look, it's inscribed.
Oh, you knew him?
Yeah, I knew him. Yeah, I knew he and his girlfriend.
When you were in Dublin?
When I was in Kinsale.
Right.
2005 was What the Hell Am I Doing on Planet Earth.
See? Now, there it is. Planet Earth, chemical body environment. He spends very little time there. He's in the discarnate space. So one does tend to wonder, why do I still have a chemical body, and what's it doing here, since I'm more involved in the chip body and TV body, see? So that's the whole mediascape evokes that question about the old space.
Mm. The other one, Love, The Mystery and Foundation, was printed in, it's an old one, 1989.
And what's the theme there? Do you remember? What's he claim love is?
He's it's a compilation of different people talking about love, I think, in order to figure out what the hell it is.
He interviewed people.
I don't know that they're interviews as much as just quoting. And, like, Alice Bailey is in here, and
You mean Alice Bailey, the theosophist woman?
Yes.
Okay, so it's like old mentors, wise people.
Right, exactly. Some American Indians, Margaret Mead, David Spangler. Jeez.
Oh, Spangler. He's the guru of William Irwin Thompson back in the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
He might be up in Whitby Island in Seattle area. He's the one who sort of was the guru for Findhorn. He was a beginning point.
Oh, yeah. He was a Findhorn guy. That's right. Yeah, well, he was, yeah.
So this, it sounds like this is a lot of theosophical New Age inspired stuff. Was Rodney or whatever his name, what did you say his name was?
Roderick Knowles.
Roderick, was he into the theosophical heritage?
Yeah.
So he made an inventory of love. Now, could one do that in 1600? Could you write a book with all these different opinions on love? No, because you wouldn't have that many books. In the 19th century, did they have famous people comment on love? I don't think they have that kind of book because there weren't so many celebrities back then. There might be a Charles Dickens or a Jane Eyre or something, but you wouldn't have a whole range of people worrying about what the heck love was. Everybody knew what love was back in the 19th century.
Everyone knew what love was back in the 19th century.
Yeah, it was a strong castle against a storm of creeping industry. You protected your family from the slings and fates of the horrible urban landscape. That was what love was.
And now we know it's just a force field.
Well, no. Don't quote Ion. This is before
Ion. Okay, jeez.
Yeah. Now we know that love... that you don't have to defend your love fortress, your family anymore, because you got TV to distract you, you got a welfare society, you got unemployment insurance. You can slack off and be relaxed and join a nudist colony or a swap club and get divorced and father kids or mother kids all over the place or blow them up if you're a terrorist. You're not worried about holding the fort anymore on the nuclear family level. So that's why we wouldn't know. That's why we need Roderick's book to help us get our bearings on what love was so that we could see what it is today. Remember I posted that interview with McLuhan on love? He did for the Canadian magazine Maclean's in 1967. I don't know if you read that. His approach to love was way different because he was considering the discarnate effect.
Huh.
If you haven't read that, I'll bring your attention to it.
Yeah, I don't think I had.
Yeah, it's probably not even comprehensible when you read it.
Well, that might be why I didn't read it.
Yeah, maybe you started it and said, no, this guy knows nothing about love. This is not the love that Roderick talks about. Deepak Chopra wouldn't recognize this love. Lynn Andrews wouldn't write a novel about it. So.
Oh, my God. Yeah, it's not soft and sacred and mushy.
Yeah, no wonder Bob screwed up. No wonder he's disrespectful to every walking chemical body on the earth because he certainly wouldn't know about love if he went by McLuhan's definition.
Oh.
All these, the thing is, they're all quaint. It's like an ancient, dusty, puny time is what these books remind you of.
Mm.
Not puny for you. Puny on the media ideascape.
Okay. The next one I have is
Wait a minute. Don't they seem old and quaint and
well,
silly?
Well, definitely. Yeah, some of them do. You know, especially this one about, you know, 1989 and all these different quotes put together. I mean...
Okay, so Roderick did the one about Earth. What does that – we didn't go into that. What's that about?
What the hell am I doing on planet Earth? The story of creation from the creator's perspective.
Not from the PR perspective of the advertising guys who are the real creators of massive memes, but from the obsolete little person and his little puny creative process, formerly known as creator. Here lies. Rest in peace, creator.
Okay, bringing together the cutting-edge insights of science along with those of mystics, poets, esoterics, ancient wisdom teachings, and those of the world's greatest religions. So again, he's doing a compilation of different things.
Of his own reading, his own reading and influences and heroes.
Exactly.
And why does it come to the question, what on earth? See, he's saying we don't know where we are. He's assuming there's an audience out there that doesn't know where they are anymore. And he thinks old wisdom might help them get their bearings.
Yeah, I guess that would be true.
And science. But we know that it certainly doesn't deal with the media dynamics. Again, it's a failed operation. It might sell a few copies, but you consider it. Is it some? You don't mind getting rid of the book, right? It's not a sacred object, this book, for you.
No.
Is there any book that's a sacred object for you now? Any particular book you will save?
The only books I've really been saving are art books, like a book on Chagall or Klimt or,
right,
Sistine Chapel. There isn't really anything from a spiritual perspective of reading that I don't turn to. My God, I did that religiously for 10 years, but now, nope.
Do you paint more now than you did 10 years ago when you're reading those books?
Yeah, no, I paint a lot more now.
Okay, so that's partly what the books were pointing to. You know, in a sense, you're fulfilling the old-fashioned ideal of having time to paint and be creative in the old sense, in the chemical body sense. So you don't read about it anymore. You're going to see when you have time to do it, and you've got the time to do it, and then you're going to do it, and use these books as practical books, the art books.
Yeah, just I look at, because I like looking at them. It just makes me happy to see some of that stuff. That's why.
And it's reminding you of the activity of painting.
Right.
So that's your mythic stage. Your mythic stage is painting. Those are the materials. Those are your technologies that you value. And you put all your energies of self, whatever you might call about self-sacredness, are invested in the act of painting.
Pretty much.
So is that the end of the books?
There's two more. There's one that's called Love and Courage by Hugh Prather, which is they're poems written by him.
Okay, that sounds horrible. Was he Irish?
I don't think so.
Where would you find this book?
Conversely,
why would you have
this
book? This
was a gift. I can't even remember by who now.
And what is the birth date? What age is this guy a poet of?
Oh, he's contemporary.
His name is Hugh somebody.
Hugh Prather.
Okay, what's the other book?
Spirit Map. Follow the exquisite geometry of art and nature back to your center.
Who's that by?
Joanna Aretum.
But these are books, spirit maps of what? Of sacred places?
No, they're art. Some of them are like Aboriginal art. But they all have like patterns to them. There's patterns.
So labyrinths, it's patterns that are mazes for spiritual journeys.
Yeah, that's a good, yep.
And they got pictures of them?
Yeah, some of them are photographs. Some of them are paintings. Like you've got Spiral Galaxy in there.
Yeah, this is what my tiny note chart makes fun of. Orphic Baroque spirals. McLuhan said we'll see spirals everywhere. He said that in the 70s. And spirals was the last vestige of visual space overlaid by acoustic simultaneity. And that creates the action of a spiral. So spirals, that movement is a couch to fall back on, to be a couch potato in, because you can't handle the non-visualizing, the post-spiraling of discarnate multi-bodied expression, which can't be visualized, and people think of the fractal, more accurately would be the anamorphosis image, the trompe-l'oeil, the trick of the eye. We get more to what the present is. So these are simple reductionist forms based
well,
on a...
Okay, I don't know about reductionist. Well, I mean, there's an image on each page in color, and you're supposed to meditate on them.
Yeah, it's
and
all eyeball stuff. Well, do they give sounds to accompany them?
Well, it's like it says, okay, this one here is the throat chakra. And, no, it doesn't give sounds. But it talks about what it, like, supports or affects.
What it supports?
A picture of whatever it is that, you know, is in, it's a painting. Most of them are paintings.
And you meditate on the painting to activate your one chakra.
Yes.
So that's a sacred spot. That's like the arc. That's a power image.
Uh-huh.
You get your power from something external.
Right.
See, more and more today with the making your own spaces digitally, you have to rely on yourself. So the old idea of projecting something outside of yourself that would give you your power gets weaker and more anemic.
Sometimes it's just power, but it can also just be supporting something. It doesn't have to be you're giving power. I mean, you know.
It's just giving you a place of poise and quiet and away from the media storm. When you were meditating 10 years ago, you never even had no image of yourself typing messages to people and having a Facebook page and interacting and responding to emails and voicemail, right? You had no image of that.
No.
So did anything prepare you for that? Did all this poise, meditative, relaxation, sacred space, did it prepare you for the life you're in now with your chip body?
No. No.
Right. But McLuhan did talk about that and warn you about it.
Hmm.
See, there it is. McLuhan's the only guy left standing from any kind of genre of improvement, self-protection literature. He's not seen as that, but he actually turns out to be the best of all of that if you want to use McLuhan for that purpose.
If you want to. Yeah, actually some of these have accompanying sounds that you chant. So there you are.
A few tiny sounds. Now look, and that's reacting to the wealth of sound, which of course is too much of music and that for people, so they get turned off. See, there's the pollution is not in the ozone, or in the lakes, it's in the mediascape. And it's just a psychological vomiting after you've eaten too much. And the buffet is so huge of what you can consume. That creates alienation. That's the pollution. It's an information pollution environment, not a physical pollution.
Hey, we forgot my favorite one, the game of life and how to play it.
Who's that by?
Florence Scovel Shinn.
Oh, yeah, that's the one in the 1920s?
Yeah.
Well, the game of life and how to play it. Everybody
this
knows
one, it. Yeah, but I love this one because it's so simple and there's hardly any work.
Ah, okay, so it's the one you're going to keep.
I'm keeping this one at least for nostalgia.
Yeah, for when you could know something. The days when you could know and appreciate simplicity. Yeah, it's a memento of that state of mind. Or that,
I'm screwed
that desire.
Now. That's well over, yeah.
Okay, so the game of life, just the title, is now the game of chemical bodies, and the chemical bodies are the games today. Nothing is called the cynical average citizen. Very cynical about chemical bodies. And I notice when you watch youth movies, youth movies. The kids are like in their teens, they're very cynical about the moves. They comment on each other's chemical body moves because they've watched a lot of TV presentations of the chemical body soap operas and situation dramas that they fully know the limitations of the chemical body and what its possible motives are. So the game of life.
What do you mean by moves when you say chemical body moves?
Well, look at any movie that's geared for people like from 18 to 25.
Mm-hmm.
You look at any of those movies, the kids, they're always second-guessing what they're going to say to somebody because they know the other person knows.
Yes. Yeah, okay.
It's hyper cynical, hyper ironic, and snarky remarks. It's like the the other guy, not Jay Leno, but the other Corbin guy. Forget his name. Colin. Who's the other?
The Irish
Colin
guy?
O'Brien. Conan O'Brien.
Conan?
Yeah.
Conan. Okay. Yeah.
That kind of snarky. I mean, I saw him once or twice, and a guest comes on. The guest can only say a couple words before Conan knows what the whole situation is and makes a remark about it.
Yeah.
It's all the routines of the chemical body are pretty noble for people younger and younger and younger. And so the game of life, that title would not work. What would be the game? And people live video games. They live literal games all the time. So you'd have to say, I think the best line for any of these books is there life before death? I think that summarizes how you get people's attention now. Is there life because it's humorous? It could update it, but it's the fate of the chemical body. Is there life for the chemical body before death?
Hmm.
And these books we've run through are attempts to resuscitate, artificial resuscitation for an image of the chemical body and its archetypal sacred spaces. And they have not served us well.
No,
and
they have not.
You have not ignited any interest in books in this conversation. I'm glad I don't have any. And
you don't have any furniture to put them on, so it's just as well you don't have any.
I got a garage. I got a couple of shelves. Carolyn has books. Now, she's a voracious book reader. She just piles them up. It's incredible. It's all candy or something for her, McDonald's burgers or something. She's reading books, watching movies, and answering emails. The whole world runs to her for advice, and she's just there playing away.
But the whole world does revolve around her, so it's a good thing.
You say it does? What's a good thing?
That she's doing all that. She's
oh, yeah.
She's taking care of business.
Well, she keeps her eyeball going, and she's saving the Noah's Ark of the Gutenberg galaxy and the movie Hollywood galaxy by watching all this stuff and reading. And it's incredible. The books, they pile up, and I put them on the shelves in the garage, and yet she's, like, doing all this modern, very modern stuff, as well as interacting emails. I mean, geez.
That's cool.
It's five-bodied expression. We'll call her emails or chip body. So she has a very active chip body life, active TV body life, and that's usually interviews in major media. And then her chemical body life is processing books and movies, keeps that going. And her astral body life might be seen as ion, but it's more than the astral body, but includes the astral body zone. So she's got full five-body expression going. Millennial Ecstasies of Five Body Expression by Dr. Carolyn Bean.
Well, I would expect no less.
That's right, because she lives with it. The Android meme, right? Living with the Android meme. Is there life? Is there life?
Is there life living with the Android meme?
Is anything alive?
Is there a reason to get up in the morning with the Android meme?
That's right. Yep. And How I Survived the Android Meme by facing it straight on and confronting it and marrying it and fucking it and feeding it.
Watching the motherfucker burn.
Making fun of him. Right in public. So,
okay, we've exhausted the library. Yay, now I can get rid of them all.
Yes, Bob, I approve that they should go into the garbage bin, except for the Game of Life.
Yeah, that one I'm keeping because it's the oldest and it makes me laugh.
Maybe there's another someday. Okay, part two would be to then consider ionic knowledge and relate it to her book, what she says. So if you can find stuff in there.
Yeah, that would be good.
So we'll go through her books. It's only one worth analyzing, and it's a long time ago, and then see how she approximates what people think Ion is saying.
Yeah, because it comes pretty close at times, but I know close is only good for horseshoe and hand grenade.
That's right. You didn't use a quote from her to sum up the fact. You had to use Ion to summarize.
I know. I had to fall back. Sorry.
Yeah, you fall back on Ion. This is a great book because I quote Ion. Thus spake Ion about this book. Okay, well, very good, Sheila. I have to go on to another cult now, so
okay.
I must address. I mean, Carolyn has emails to answer. I've got phone calls to answer.
Well, we appreciate the work you do more than you know.
I assure you, it's not work.
I know.
If it's not fun, then it's. If it's begun, if it be, we be, we appreciate the fun that you do, Bob. See, that's the way it should be said.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So we will. I will press the sign off button. Okay.
Okay.